From Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. And welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I are working in Rio this week and review our impressions of this interesting and energetic country on the move.
These were non-violent protests. Whether they will result in anything is anyone's guess, but a very good point if we're looking from a democratic point of view.
Later, Rebecca Cruz talks with Harvard political scientist Beth Simmons about what factors influence government to enact laws against modern-day slavery.
One of the factors that was highly correlated with early criminalization of human trafficking among the states was the proportion of church attendance.
Framing the debate about human rights. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Rebecca Cruz, we've been working in Rio de Janeiro this week, and Brazil, of course, is always an interesting story. We hear often about it on the news, up-and-coming country, but what we often hear is about carnival and, you know, just the typical stories about Brazil, the beautiful people and all of its sunny weather. But we also heard about the World Cup and the upcoming Olympics. And while we've been here this week, we visited a lot of universities and a lot of officials, and we've learned a lot about high-tech Rio and some of the technologies that they've been developing, particularly because they have a large oil industry here, of course. Deep water offshore drilling. They're drilling like 7 kilometers down to reach their oil reserves. But they also have made quite a lot of accomplishments in terms of high-tech agricultural development. Brazil is a rugged country. It's a very large and rugged country. They don't have a lot of agricultural areas, so they've had to develop a lot of technological capabilities to grow more food out of the small amounts of land that they have that's capable to grow food. So interesting lessons we've learned. What do you make of it?
Yes, always the contradictions. But as you say, we have these stereotypes. And right now, the Brazilian economy is suffering, and we'll get to that in a second. But in the last half decade or even full decade, Brazil has really grown. And a lot of that has come from these new developments, these new technologies, particularly the oil drilling. As you say, they are still drilling oil, and we know that those the amount of oil that in the world right now is grown quite a bit. So those prices are down significantly, which is affecting the economy. But lots of really creative people, really smart people at the universities, everyone that we have run into has just been really, really impressive and really presenting another side of Brazil that I think less people are aware of. They really do seem to be moving ahead, thinking about new ways to do things and grow things. And that's why Brazil has been somewhat successful, really successful for the last decade, but somewhat successful here recently.
It definitely strikes you as a country on the move. And as I've reported before from Brazil about the energy here, there's just a lot of, I don't mean oil energy, I mean just energy among the people, this incredible love of life, even though, as we hear from everyone, actually life is not always easy here. But and speaking of that, I mean, you mentioned the economic problems or the economic downturn, political scandal, of course, very recently, a couple weeks ago or less, there were massive protests in this country calling actually for the president to resign. And she was just reelected last October. But this comes on the heels of course, some economic downturn. You mentioned the drop in oil prices, but also scandal. There's major scandal going on in Petrobras, their main oil company. So tell us a little bit about what might be going on there.
Their main oil company that you mentioned, that actually the president was the chairwoman when these corruption charges are alleged to have happened. So yes, she was elected in October, and she had right after that, if we look at some of the polling, about a 48% approval rating. That in February dropped to just above 20%, and she's faced some challenges here. Now, these corruption scandals, those are not just Brazilian. Those can happen in any country, but when you throw in the economic troubles that they've had, as well as some drought that's been going on in the country, the worst droughts since the 1930s, this causes quite a bit of political tensions and conflicts. And yes, her resignation has been called for, or even impeachment. So the corruption scandal started to trickle out before the election, and there is some indication that had it trickled out a little bit earlier, that perhaps she wouldn't have gotten reelected. Though there are other indications from some of the people that we've talked to that she's being targeted. But when it really comes down to it, it looks like the state-run oil company perhaps was funneling money into her campaign. And there are about, I think it's 34 sitting politicians that are under investigation right now. 32 of them are actually from her party. So there may be something significant here. And she doesn't have the economic growth and the economic power right now to be able to really try to deal with that and skirt that. So it's going to be a rough couple of months for her if she can't deal with this and somehow get this taken care of.
Well, of course, to be fair, she has been cleared of charges, supposedly, but she was, as you said, the chair of the board when this apparently these scandals happened. And these are not small scandals. These are huge scandals. You know, the kickbacks and the corruption has cost that company millions and millions and millions of dollars, and has really reduced the value of the company. So this underlying current of concern about basically stealing from the people of Brazil is very real. But on the other hand, we hear people are saying, this is democracy. This is what you do in a democratic country. And the fact that you can turn out maybe up to 1 million people on the streets is really something that we should celebrate.
Yeah, this is the largest protest, political protest, since the country came back to democracy in the 1980s. Over 1 million people is the estimate, somewhere around that, in every region of the country. So, yes, perhaps that is something positive to look at. These were nonviolent protests. Whether they will result in anything is anyone's guess, but a very good point if we're looking from a democratic point of view.
Well, clearly Brazil is a country still to watch, so we'll be returning again to Rio. But thanks, Rebecca, as always, for being with me in this country and others. Thank you.
It's been a fantastic trip. Thank you.
If you have any thoughts about this conversation, let us know by leaving your questions and comments in the Worldview section of our website. We also welcome your feedback on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Gralat, and at Cruise226. You can also subscribe to our podcast and download the show from iTunes, and read transcripts and in-depth recaps of all of our interviews at KGOU.org. Next, Rebecca continues our ongoing look at human trafficking with Beth Simmons, a political scientist at Harvard University. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. Our guest today is Beth Simmons. She's a political scientist at Harvard University, where she studies cooperative approaches to countering human trafficking, money laundering, and other forms of transnational crime. She's the author of the 2009 book, Mobilizing for Human Rights, International Law and Domestic Politics. She spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Beth Simmons, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're here today to talk a little bit about transnational crime. I think this is a concept that we hear all the time, and we have a sense that it has developed and changed and grown. But perhaps you could start off by just telling us what exactly transnational crime is, what it looks like, where we're seeing it most often, and perhaps how it has changed.
Well, transnational crime is criminal activity that maybe begins in one state and has consequences or is perpetrated in another state, crossing international lines. We can also think of transnational crime as rings or cooperative groups of individuals who operate as an organization that also crosses borders.
And in terms of commodities here, we're talking about the trafficking or the smuggling of weapons, drugs, animal products in some cases, and humans, mm-hmm. amongst other things.
I think you hit the big ones. I think probably the biggest market segment is going to be in the area of drug trafficking, narcotics trafficking. In addition to that, I think you're right to think of the trade in weapons. We can think of a large segment of the market being trade in small weapons that we find used in various civil conflicts in different countries around the world, and also to commit crimes, of course, locally in several countries around the world. I think another area of transnational crime that is smaller in absolute numbers, but in some ways some of the most tragic, does have to do with moving human beings against their will.
So as we think about this, we certainly have heard a lot more, particularly perhaps about human trafficking, but about this global trade in general, particularly since the 1990s. This is something that seems to be more on our radar. But why are we seeing this increase? Is this technology? Is it other factors at play?
I think one of the big reasons that we see a lot more transnational crime, I think I would point to two things. First of all, with the liberalization of the global economy over the course of the 1990s, 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s, it's just become easier to move goods and people from one location to another. When we think of the ease of transporting goods, the dropping prices of shipping, the ease of movement of human beings across borders, these are all things that just give rise to market activity. And some of the market activity of most market activity, of course, is licit, and a lot of it has been banned. One big reason why you see a growth in transnational crime is that more things have become criminalized over time. And a good example of that would be the growing number of narcotics that are now banned in international law, the rise of agreements to ban trade in certain kinds of protected species, and new bans now and international legal agreements specifically designed to prohibit and ban the trafficking of human beings across borders as well. There were not explicit international agreements in these areas only a few decades ago. And now that there are, more and more things are falling into this category of a transnational crime.
So transnational crime, these are people across borders working together, sometimes through organized criminal organizations, sometimes perhaps not. But that also requires then a transnational response. You mentioned international treaties, international laws, which can be difficult to implement. But this really does require cooperation among states, between states. Are we seeing enhanced cooperation in this area? Are police forces working together, sharing information, enhanced transparency?
I think that's probably true. There has been, I think, a tremendous growth in cooperative engagement and cooperative programs between police forces across borders. The United States has enhanced its cooperation with officials on both sides of the border, both north and south. But another really good example of this would be within Europe, where there is now the growth in European-wide police cooperation in the form of arrest warrants that, for example, are recognized across Europe. So a European arrest warrant, making it much easier to investigate and also to prosecute criminal activity across the region. So, yeah, I think there's been a big growth in international cooperation with respect to policing. Interpol, which is an international organization of police departments, has been in existence for almost 80 years or so. But there's also been many regional counterparts to Interpol around the world. Europol is an example, where European police forces increasingly share information and cooperate with one another on prosecuting. Asianpol, ASEANpol is another example. So different parts of the world, you see this rise in efforts to extend the possibility of cooperative policing beyond the boundaries of the sovereign nation states.
That's political scientist Beth Simmons. She studies transnational crime and human trafficking at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We'll hear more of her conversation with Rebecca Cruz right after this short break. I'm Suzette Grolot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, we're hearing from Beth Simmons, a Harvard political scientist who studies issues of transnational crime. When we left off, she said there's a rise in cooperative policing efforts beyond the boundaries of sovereign nations. She spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Are we seeing some of this cooperation also, say, between South and North? I mean, it seems to make sense that you would have enhanced cooperation between the United States and Canada or some of the European partners or within Europe. Mm-hmm. But as we know, many of these commodities are coming from south to north, transiting perhaps through Europe, but that the issues are in unstable countries. Are they cooperating in these international agreements or in enhanced policing activities as well?
That's a good question because, you know, it's one thing to have an agreement on paper, and it is, of course, something completely different to see effective cooperation on the ground. And, you know, sort of, as soon as you have efforts to work across different types of policing organizations with different kinds of capacities, with different kinds of legal authority, and different kind of cultural restraints on the police and legal constraints, for that matter, you do raise the issue of the difficulty of understanding the terms on which that cooperation is going to take place across police forces. So that is a very difficult issue. And it is not the case that every police organization in the world that the United States would like to have cooperative relationships with has the capacity to be an effective cooperating partner and may have very different standards of policing than the United States itself.
But as you say, we are seeing more international agreements. We're seeing more agreements through the UN to deal with some of these activities that are now gained criminal status. What is the benefit for some of these countries who maybe aren't as willing to cooperate as we might have thought, but what is the benefit of them to sign on to these agreements or to ratify some of these agreements?
Well, one example would be the United Nations Convention on Transnational Organized Crime. And that, I think, is the centerpiece to try to create an international consensus that transnational organized crime is a serious, serious issue and that states need to work together to try to counter transnational crime. I think that one of the benefits of increased ratification and at least getting countries' commitments on paper is that at least it creates a raised expectation that this is something that we all value, at least in principle, and gives us a basis for then asking those countries to ramp up their cooperation in the future. When they do ratify such conventions, it doesn't mean that they are immediately and automatically prepared to make radical changes. But it is a slow process of development. And when international agreements are ratified, then it is a matter of sort of slowly working towards developing the capacity and the normative expectation, I suppose I would say, to cooperate using police forces, for example, for judicial institutions across countries to cooperate with one another and in some ways aim our aid programs in ways that can effectively develop those capacities as well.
So these international conventions, documents, efforts at cooperation are significant and important, perhaps an early step in trying to tackle some of these issues. Now, you have done research and have talked on the issue of how these sorts of things are framed, how they get support from actors or other interested parties. And you found some interesting findings or are able to relate some interesting findings about the use of the word crime or the criminal frame in dealing with human rights issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's take one of the areas where transnational crime has recently gotten a lot of attention, I think both in terms of political mobilization and in the media, and that's the area of human trafficking. And groups have organized to try to bring the issue of human trafficking to the attention of policymakers in the United States, at the level of the United Nations, and elsewhere around the world. And, you know, this has been an issue that has really risen on the international agenda very, very quickly. And I think one reason this is the case is while it was initially framed as a human rights issue, that is, you know, we think of the transportation of unwitting victims from one country to another, and they find themselves then employed in situations where they're being abused, where they're not being paid, where they're treated poorly, where they have lack of freedom of movement. That's what we would consider to be human trafficking. And of course, it's a serious human rights issue. And groups mobilize around this set of concerns about the victim. So that brings the issue to the agenda, but states don't always respond to that human rights framing of the issue. And rather, they tend to respond, I found, looking at the language of resolutions at the United Nations, I found that there's been an evolution away of thinking about human trafficking as a rights issue and towards seeing it as part of this broader trend in transnational crime, linked up, for example, with rings that also traffic drugs, linked up with rings that are involved in money laundering, weapons trafficking, etc. And when states understand that this movement in human beings may have a lot to do with these broader transnational crime trends, then they seem willing to take strong effort to do something about it. Less so when it's framed as a human rights issue.
That's interesting. Would we see that in the United States then as well?
I think to a certain extent. I was looking also at data on the various states within the United States that have criminalized human trafficking and found a very interesting phenomenon. You see evidence both of concerns about transnational crime, but also about human rights issues and issues about victims. So one thing, when we looked at the data, one of the factors that was highly correlated with early criminalization of human trafficking among the states in the United States was the proportion of church attendance in states.
Church attendance. That's
church
interesting.
Attendance. Yeah, I thought that was interesting as well. But I associate it with the very strong and consistent lobbying activity and advocacy activity that many churches have taken in this issue area. And their focus does tend to be on the rights and the protections of the victim and bringing the plight of the victim to public attention. So that is one interesting phenomenon, and yet another one that really has a bit more to do with the sort of fear of vulnerability or transnational crime, is that another strong predictor of early criminalization of human trafficking among the 50 states is whether a state has an international airport and has a border with a foreign country or borders on the seacoast. So that conjures up images of being much more vulnerable to these transnational kinds of organizations than the sort of first effect that I gave you about the influence of the more religious organizations advocating more the human rights angle.
So multiple frames to deal with the issues here in this country, and certainly broader and multiple frames to deal with human trafficking and transnational crime internationally. So very, very interesting topics, and we'll continue to see how things develop. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Harvard political scientist Beth Simmons. There's more information on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hardzinski produces the show and prepared this week's web post. Symphony Swift books our guests and oversees the research, and our intern this semester is Sam Dupre. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Guerlotte.